welcome all of you to this workshop on the Competition Act, page 9 of 1998, as amended in 2008. Just want to correct one thing. Today we are not going to consider any amendment, an amendment bill. Today we're going to be looking at the the act as it is, pre-amendment. It's a matter of familiarizing ourselves with the act so as to really know upon receiving the tabled amendment. Know exactly what we will be looking at and from what perspective. The Act as it stands now is a very big volume of a document. If you do not interpret it correctly, it might have a problem, but mainly when I look at it, it's all about transformation, transforming the economy, guarding against the cartels within the economy that are making it very difficult actually for emerging firms and also for the sum of the existing firms to grow. So it's a very, very good law after we have seen in some countries what their laws are all about. Ours, I think, is a very good one, especially for the benefit of our SACU countries and also SADC countries. Even though one of our SACU members doesn't have competition law as yet, that is Lesotho, but we all know that all other SACU members do have. But the challenge that we are having is how do we manage cartels within both SACU and SADC, all 14 member states of SADC. It is important that when we look at this, we look at it broadly, and as we are going to be workshopped, we don't just receive, but we interact with the presenters for the purposes of deeply understanding the Act itself, and also for the purpose of policy revision, because competition policy is quite important for the country. As it stands now, it gives emphasis, or it puts emphasis on job creation, on poverty reduction, and also it also talks about equality. If we don't have equal participation in the economy of the country, we will have dire consequences. So it means poverty will continue to be there, inequality will continue to be there, and creation of jobs will be a thing of the past, not only in South Africa, but also in the region itself and continent itself. So as it is, cartels participate also in the continent, and they can serve as a barrier to incoming and also the growth of the existing companies. So it is important that we look at the objectives of the Act, and we look at it with an open mind, a mind of giving effect to the inputs that will be given in the near future when we look at the amendments. I just wanted to say that so that as we engage, we have that open mind. We have a list of presenters today. And before I go into that, may I first welcome all of you and wish you a prosperous 2018 and hope that before we rise up for election purposes, campaign purposes, we would have finished the job before us. And we would have had an opportunity to also wrap up our work so that those who will be coming after us have the handover report ready, illustrating all the work that we have done ever since we started. Hence, this year we are going to hold a review session where we're going to be looking at our work, what we managed to do and what we have not managed to do, and where we think those who will be coming after us should actually look at or emphasize on as a recommendation. That doesn't mean we're going to be dictating to them on what to do, but we're going to just suggest that these are the areas that we feel they should continue looking at. After saying that, let me take this opportunity to welcome Mentokozo Hlonyana, who's here representing the Economic Freedom Fighters. I think we know that we have bid farewell to Comrade Mbatha, and the EFF has then seconded the rep to this committee. You are mostly welcome, ma'am. Yes, we hope your contribution will really contribute towards the growth of this team in terms of the issues that we'll be discussing. As Ubabu Mbatha was doing, we hope in the same from you. All the best in your participation in this team. This is exactly a team. We might differ somewhere else, but as we gather here, we discuss issues. And where we don't agree, we agree to disagree, but we don't fight. We stay as united as possible. Because we take it that we are all Adams. And if we don't see things in the same eye, it's okay. Doesn't kill anyone. And then we have a broader platform where we discuss, and that is in the chamber. So that's where we discuss our views broadly. But welcome to this team. We also want to welcome back Dr. Kado. I don't know whether it was a sabbatical leave, but you welcome back. We missed you, and we're hoping that you'll be here once more to participate as you were participating before. I'm not sure if Mr. Atkinson is still coming. We hope he is, but we'd have loved to start with everybody, you know, present. Okay. After declaring the meeting open, let me ask our research officer to come forward and give us a presentation on what she has prepared in as far as competition law is concerned. I've asked Novisa to focus mainly on the role of legislature, the role of the executive, the role of civil society in as far as this is concerned, and the Competition Commission will focus on the law itself. We had requested actually the legal office, but there's been a misunderstanding between our support staff and them in exactly what they were supposed to prepare on. But apart from that, the only four that are dealing with the law, interpretation of the law in Parliament, and I'm told to have resigned, they only left two, so they are really understaffed. They have requested that we give them, when I spoke to them, they requested that we give them more time, because we still want them to talk to us on the legal areas within the law itself, just to give us more clarity. So they have requested that we give them up to 2 weeks. They said we should give them the 2 weeks, so the first week of March, they said they will be ready to be here. So I would love them to really come and talk to us about that, because they will also be advising us on the amendments. So it is only fair that they come and prepare us, so that as we engage with the amendments, with the bill, we understand where we're coming from. Nolisa, please come forward.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. I spoke, I had a chat with the Chair about today, and she asked me to do several things, and one of those things was to look at the role of the executive legislature in civil society. But also, she asked me to just do a refresher on what is competition policy, why is it important, why should we be focusing on it. And I thought it would be interesting to do a refresher and just look at where competition policy comes from, look briefly at other jurisdictions as well. So this is not just for today, but as Chair has said, that the legal services will be presenting on the Act as well. So when they present on the Act, I think I'll also have an opportunity to focus on the role. But I thought today, let me just start with the fundamentals, just a brief overview of competition policy in general. So I'll start off with where competition policy comes from. Basically, competition policy is an old policy, but I'll start from the 1890s, 1889 and 1890, where the first national competition law was established in Canada and in the United States. And economist Joseph Stiglitz says that the reason why the competition law was promulgated in the United States specifically was because they wanted to promote a political agenda. It was a political agenda to try and limit market and political power of trust. So I'll just explain what that means. So what happened in North America was that after the Civil War, there was rapid industrialization, and because of rapid industrialization, there were new companies. There was manufacturing was booming, and so there were new businesses, new companies that were coming up, and so this led to overcapacity, and there was a lot of competition, and because of competition, there was a lot of price wars. Because of the price wars, business owners were suffering because they had to bring down prices for the consumers. Whatever goods that they were selling, They had to look at their neighbor, how much are you charging for that? And so if you're charging 5 rand, I'll try and charge 4 and 50. So they were not making a lot of profit. As a result of that, they tried to, they came up with a survival strategy, and so they formed, they made agreements, and they formed trusts in order to respond to this rivalry. So because of those trusts and cartels, consumers were hurt because prices went up and small businesses were squeezed out of the market. There was a public outcry, government had to intervene, and so the competition law, the Sherman Act in America was promulgated. But what is competition policy? Competition policy is a set of policies and law which ensures that competition in the marketplace is not restricted in a way that is detrimental to society. But I'll start from the beginning and look at why competition. Competition is basically a free market principle that promotes rivalry, competition between firms. Why do they promote competition between firms? Because it brings prices down and it's good for the market. So if a firm operates in a highly competitive environment, or it operates in an environment that has no competition, it will do things differently. So in terms of a economy, you look at the environment, at the market, you try and understand, is this market competitive? So we start from the different categories that are there. There are different categories or different types of markets. So if you look at page 7, market structure, these markets are categorized in terms of structure. So number 1 is perfect competition. What is perfect competition? Perfect competition is when there are many market, there are many firms, there's freedom of entry, and they sell the same product. For example, if you go down the down King Street, you find that you have hawkers who are selling the same thing, and you find that the price is almost the same. If the price of the first person, first seller that you see is a bag of nectarines is 10 rand, the next one will also sell for 10 rand, and the next one will also sell that bag for 10 rand. So that is ideal. You want people to compete so that prices can stay the same. And then we've got another form of structure, which is called monopolistic competition. Monopolistic competition is when there are many firms. But you'll find, for example, if you go to the waterfront, there are different restaurants in the same area, and one specializes in curry, the other one specializes in healthy food. But the point is, they're all restaurants, and so they try and differentiate themselves based on small things like taste or interest, people's in. The style of or the environment of their restaurant. So there you find that there's little margin for increasing prices. Whereas in the first one there was no margin for increasing prices. The prices were just the same, 5 rand or 10 rand all the way. So here you find that a person will say, no, I use a special ingredient, so they can charge you 5 rand extra for that. But there's still competition. And then you have an oligopoly. An oligopoly is when there are very few firms in that market. For instance, the telecom sector, you find that you can count them, there's Telkom, there's Neotel, not Neotel, there's Telkom, there's Vodacom, there's MTN, you know. So a structure like that is called an oligopoly if there aren't many firms. And there's a margin of they would be able to change prices. The reason why they can change, they have power to change prices because they're very few. So unlike the first one, which is ideal, this one in oligopolies can affect the prices that they charge of products. Then you have a monopoly. Monopoly, there's only one firm, and there are barriers to entry. Sometimes the reason why there are barriers to entry, you'll find that is because it's very costly to set up maybe a telecoms company or an Eskom, or so it's not easy to enter that market. So there, they've got significant power to change prices. So they can just determine that, okay, we want to charge 50 rand, and so because there's no competition, I'm just making an example, because there's no competition, people are forced to come to me, and therefore I will charge them whatever I want to charge them. And as a result, they will make a lot of profit. So under perfect competition, firms just make normal profit. Under monopoly, firms make a lot of profit at the expense of consumers. So basically, that is where competition policy, those are the fundamentals of competition, where competition policy comes from. Differences between markets, competitive markets and monopoly or oligopoly markets. So perfect competition is an ideal, but it is generally accepted that it is good. The reason why it is good is that it is socially efficient, and it results in efficiencies in the allocation of resources that is efficient. There's no single market there that has power to change prices, and if a firm charges higher prices, a consumer can simply move to the next person, to the next firm, where they will get satisfaction. So some of the advantages of perfect competition is that they maintain a high quality standard, because you're in competition, you cannot afford to sleep and think that people will just come to you. You have to come up with innovative ways of selling your product, and they charge reasonable prices. So you find that generally that is what markets want, competition. So why is competition important? Because it stimulates innovation, productivity, and competitiveness, contributing to effective business environment. And there's a result that generates economic growth and employment. It creates possibilities for small, medium-sized enterprises to grow. It removes barriers that protect entrenched elites and reduces opportunities for corruption. Competition, therefore, increases a country's attractiveness as a business location, triggering national and foreign investment. Competition also delivers benefits for consumers through lower prices, improved services, and greater choices. And a disclaimer there is that effective competition, those are the benefits of a competitive market. Why is competition important? I think given what I presented earlier in slide 9, I think this quote from Professor Eleanor Fox describes it well, that competition is not just about markets. It's about markets and markets that enable people to participate in economic enterprise. Markets take people out from the thumb of cronistic and autocratic states, the freedom to participate in economic enterprise and not to be swept aside by privilege and power is not only a personal freedom that enhances dignity, but a source of livelihood that lifts people out of poverty by empowering them. So that basically is why it's important for markets to be competitive. So the number of firms, if we look at an economy, you look at the number of firms that are there. The number of firms will tell you whether the market is competitive or not. So as I indicated earlier, if there are many firms in that industry, then you know that the market is competitive. However, sometimes there will be many firms, but you'll find that there are only two or three, just a few firms that have got market power, that produce 95% over 45% of that industry's products. So even though there are many firms, you can still have two or three that have got market power, and that is called concentration. Then you find that if market power is centered around just a few people or just a few firms, then that environment is highly concentrated. Market power is when firms have market power over prices. They can use this to exploit consumers, raise prices, and market power enables them to make normal profits above perfectly competitive level at the expense of the consumer. Market power is not necessarily a bad thing, because if it's not abused, if it's not abused and instead it's used to promote competition, research and development, and innovation, then it is acceptable. However, I like this quote also by Joseph Stiglitz, that you must be wary of market power, because he says that it needs to be attacked because it leads to inequality, poor economic performance, lower growth, and and instability. Because when you have a lot of market power, you are tempted to abuse that power in the market. So you find that where there's market power, sometimes you find a lot of cartels because of that market power, because people are able to change prices and no one is challenging them. Whereas if you know that if I increase these prices and someone else brings them down, then I'm going to lose profits, then you would behave differently. So Stiglitz further says that market power is often associated with creating barriers to entry, and inequality means fewer people have resources to enter those markets. These problems can be particularly serious when foreign firms have market power. For if foreign firms have got market power, it's very easy for them to generate profit and then take that profit and take it to their country of origin. So the problem will be that there won't be effective redistribution of resources there. So the whole point of competition has got to do with who's got market power. So because perfect competition is an ideal, the markets are generally not perfect. You find that they're imperfect markets. And those imperfect markets, as I mentioned earlier, are the monopoly markets, oligopoly markets, and monopolistic competition markets. So the problem with imperfect competition is that sometimes it doesn't lead to the efficient allocation of resources. So although free market proponents will say that we need to follow the principles of a free market, the problem is that there's sometimes market failure. An example is the global financial crisis, or you'll find that firms like monopolies or oligopolies, firms will tend to extortionate charges, restrict output, cause deterioration of services, and unfair discrimination. So markets do not always achieve the desired welfare goals, because then under imperfect markets, especially where power is abused, you'll find that resources will be concentrated only on a few firms or a few individuals. So that is why government has to intervene in markets where there's imperfect competition. They intervene so as to promote and protect the competitive process. They intervene so as to level the playing field to make sure that people, there are no barriers to entry, and people enter on the same footing where possible. So a competition law will provide the market with a set of rules or rules of the game that protects the competition process rather than the competitors, because you find that in an imperfect market like an oligopoly, monopoly, you'll find that firms want to protect themselves, but the point of having a competition law to make sure that rather than protecting firms, you protect protect the competition process rather than the individuals, because you need to have firms that are innovative, that are competitive. In this way, the pursuit of fair or effective competition can contribute to improvement in economic efficiency, economic growth, and development and welfare of the country. So different countries, there are many countries that have adopted competition policy, and mainly if you look at the United States, because it's a free market country, the main policy goal there is efficiency, that the market must be efficient. However, there are other goals for competition policy. For instance, there are non-efficiency goals. If you look at South Africa, the competition policy in South Africa entails efficiency goals. That means that the market it promotes competition and discourages anti-competitive behavior. Above that, it aims to promote the development of the economy. You'll find that it talks about equitable participation, wider ownership, especially by historically disadvantaged persons, promotion of employment and SMEs, and the broadening of ownership. There are different views to this, but if we go back to the origins of competition, what I talked about in the United States, the reason why they came up with competition policy is because markets, small businesses were being squeezed out of the market because of large trusts that were anti-competitive, and also the fear of conglomerates that would even have political power. So there are different reasons. However, the main reason why there's competition policy is to make sure that there's efficiency. However, free markets, even competition alone is not enough, especially in developing countries. Hence, you find that in South Africa, looking at our own challenges, you find that our competition policy is accompanied by equitable participation, non-efficiency goals, such as those mentioned there. In China, their competition law also looks at efficiency, also has efficiency goals attached to it, but also because they also have specific needs of China's socialist market. And I think it's the EU, didn't mention the EU. The EU as well has got efficiencies as goals, but non-efficiency goals include the facilitation of a single market, because they want to strengthen the EU as a single market. So competition policy must not just speak to efficiencies. It must also speak to the goals what that country wants to achieve in terms of economically. If we come back to South Africa, when South Africa became a democracy, we inherited an economy that was characterized by racial inequality, uncompetitive markets, high levels of concentration in both markets and corporate ownership, high levels of market concentration in many industries across the manufacturing services and agricultural sectors. So there was imperfection in our markets. At the time of the regime change, according to the OECD, there were five conglomerates with roots in mining houses that owned 84% of the stock exchange and accounted for 43%, of which one of the firms accounted for 43% of that market. So that was an imperfect market. That was, as I mentioned earlier, highly concentrated. It's imperfect. It's not what is desired because there's no efficient allocation of resources. It is concentrated amongst a few people or a few firms. So there was competition policies had to be effected there, but let's go back to where the competition policies started in South Africa. In South Africa, competition policy didn't start in 1994. There was the monopolistic conditions act of 1955, which was administered then by the Board of Trade and Industry. That board was not independent. It had to investigate cases. It was the Minister of Trade and Industry who had to make those decisions. It was regarded as very ineffective because over a period of 20 years, they only covered 18 cases, and they also used the standard analysis of public interest, but it was not effective. And they also didn't deal with measures and dominance. Then there was a commission of inquiry in 1975. It criticized the 1955 Act and called for amendments. Then there was a new competition in 1975 and a new board that was able to initiate investigations, and the law was authorized to deal with anti-competitive measures, and it created a new category of monopoly situation. So it had clauses that dealt with monopoly. However, in 1994, when there was a regime change, then came the DTI. It evaluated the competition policies in South Africa, and then the DTI, the Department of Trade and Industry, found that the previous competition laws were deficient, lacking adequate powers and proper political context. They did not deal with vertical conglomerates or ownership concentration, and they lacked pre-merger notification and meaningful merger power of control. Its prohibitions against anti-competitive conduct was weak. So that legislation was weak. It was not fulfilling the intended goals. And then the new competition act came into effect in 1998, and I will not go into detail because the competition commission will be talking about that, but this is just to give an overview of what has happened in the competition policy space in South Africa. So in 1998, the Competition Act excluded conduct or acts subject to or authorized by other legislation. So for example, what happened was there was a case where Netco and Stanbic wanted to merge. And because it was the two companies were in the financial services market, they could not, the Competition Commission could not deal with that transaction. So the Competition Act had to be changed to make sure to take into consideration other regulatory bodies and be given more power, not only to focus on just areas which focused on its sector. The Competition Commission, for instance, you had the telecom sector, the financial sector. So now it was being given powers to look into other activities that relate to other sectors. So the Competition Act was amended in 1991 and 2001 in order to clarify the role of the Competition Commission and other regulatory bodies. The Competition Act was again amended in 2009 in relation to concurrent jurisdiction between competition authorities and other sectors, market inquiries, personal criminal liability of cartel. The Competition Commission has talked extensively about that. And then there was also the issue of complex monopolies, oligopolies. The law tried to give the Competition Commission powers to clamp down on those on oligopolistic markets. However, the clause that deals with that issue has not yet been effected. And then there's also the amendment of the Competition Commission's corporate leniency program. So competition issues, competition policy has evolved, and in 2016, I remember at the end of 2016, the Competition Commission came to the committee to talk about challenges that it is facing when it comes to implementing its legislation, and I'm just going to do a recap of that. They said that there was a problem in terms of excessive litigation on technical grounds. They found that in terms of interlocutory applications, these have largely centered around access to the commission records. Progress has been made with courts in clarifying that, but almost all the decisions of the tribunal where the commission is successful against private parties are always taken on appeal. They were saying that there's a need to restrict the appeal rights. Also expressed provision on the need for the Competition Appeals Court to defer to the tribunal on merits. They spoke about a growing number of investigations and referrals, and so there were capacity constraints there. They also talked about the abuse of dominance enforcement, that there were challenges relating to calculating economic value, that is the technical aspects of looking at the abuse of dominance. The tribunal's decision, they made an example of the tribunal's decision against SAFO, which was overturned by the Competition Appeals Court. The issues of predatory pricing, challenges relating to the definition of costs, and also the move away from strict definition, more appropriate measure in terms of average. So those are technical issues that still need to be threshed out. There's also the issue of price discrimination. Provisions against price discrimination are aimed at protecting small businesses. A key challenge, however, is the requirement of the proof that transactions between different purchasers and who have different scales of economies are equivalent. There are also challenges with measures, which means that year, 2016, the Commission said that it considered approximately 400 mergers in a year. So there were also capacity constraints there. This has an impact on its resources. They mentioned that the Commission is doing well with respect to mergers. However, they need more expert advice than parties abandoning mergers that the Commission deems as problematic. So that is basically how far we've come. I was just giving a basic overview of competition policy and competition markets, because some of the of these issues are issues that will come up when we have to deal with the bill. And that's as far as I go today. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Nabisa, for the background information on the competition law. I think you did well. It was not just for refreshing members' memories, it was also for really giving new information to members so that you also acclimatize us on the origins of the competition policy itself. If we can understand that, then we know that everything in life has a purpose. And from the origins, it's very clear that the main goal was not necessarily to help. It was mainly to restrict and dominate. But then, because of the UN, many countries were able then to develop their own policies so that they are able then to manage and control according to the way they deem fit. So thank you so much for that information. May I then open the floor for comments, clarity seeking, questions, or just for clarifying or elaborating if you have any information in terms of elaboration. Just the floor is open for all of us to engage. That is Leanne.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Ms. Mbelelan, for doing good work of research on the subject. I don't have a question, Chair. Mine is just to confirm what is in the literature here on the issue of perfect competition. I just want to indicate that perfect competition is idealistic, as the presentation has indicated. It's used mostly for analytical purposes. It's used also for comparative studies. In real economies, developed economies, it does not necessarily exist. The competition is very much imperfect in real economies, hence the need for government to produce a competition act so as to ensure that the playing field is leveled. I just wanted to highlight that issue, that although in the literature it appears many times, it is idealistic, does not exist in real terms, because there is always imperfect competition in developed economies. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kliane. Any other? I can see that there is a competition policy, but for me it's still not clear to say what do we really want to achieve. If all of this that is being said here are there, I'll go to page 7, and that's talking about market structure, how is it structured. This is how it is now. Now, out of it, what do you want? what do you want to get out of it in terms of policy? Because I've not yet gone through the policy, so I'm going to ask questions because I'm not so sure to say. And one of my questions is to say, here are the structures that are there, that is how it's being explained. But exactly what do you want out of it? Do you want this policy to be binding? And if it's binding to everybody, how? Because when I go to the page 25, the challenges, where we are talking about technical ground and education, and then the growing number of investigations, you can see that there's more to what is happening. And also appeals and reviews, where private parties are taken to appeal to CAC, and sometimes it goes back. So I'm not so clear what you want to achieve out of this. And I'm also going to ask that, out of this policy, does this policy have teeth? Because we've got so many policies, but most of the time there are policies for the sake of policy. That does it have teeth to bite? Because I can see, especially these big companies, where when they do wrong, it causes collision, and it's not the same like fraud. So why is it like that? Because whether you are colluding or what, you've been robbing people, direct or indirect. So why does it have different names? That is called that big companies are colluding, but an individual will be told about stealing or being corrupt or whatever. So I just need clarity on all of these things.
Thank you, Polo. Any other? Are we all okay? All right. I just want to read the purpose of the Act so that we all on the same page, especially for those who joined us later after we had dealt with it. The purpose of the Act is to promote and maintain competition in the Republic in order, one, to promote the efficiency, adaptability, and development of the economy. So the efficiency part that Namisa was talking about is here. To provide consumers, that's B, to provide consumers with competitive prices and product choices. C, to promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans. D, to expand opportunities for South African participation in the world market and recognize the role of foreign competition in the Republic. To ensure that small and medium-sized enterprises have an equitable opportunity to participate in the economy. And lastly, to promote a greater spread of ownership, in particular to increase the ownership stakes of historically disadvantaged persons. So that's the main purpose and objective, I guess, of this Act. I think in terms of the application of the Act, that the Competition Commission is next to give the presentation. So they will then indicate on most of the issues that Nwabisa raised and that the questions here.
are raising. This is the main purpose. If you understand that purpose, and then you also understand in terms of what we've been briefed on, it is very important then to differentiate, to be able to differentiate between how our own act and policy has been crafted to deal with our own challenges of the country, taking into consideration our historic issues. It is important because we, in South Africa, is redressing more than every other thing we are addressing. Nwabisa, would you want to come in with the response, especially to the areas questions that needed clarity?
Thank you, Chair. I would like to start by saying that the reason why we have a competition, competition policy in South Africa is, yes, market efficiency, but also, as Mom Chair has said, to try and it's about redress, it's about changing the structure of the economy. Right now, the economy in South Africa is highly, the markets are high, the industries are very highly concentrated. We find that there are very few people who own who own a lot of market share of in different industries. And the reason behind that is because of the legacy of the past. When the Competition Act was promulgated, it was hoped that it was going to indeed achieve all the objectives as the Chair had read. And we saw them doing a lot. They've been very effective in terms of busting cartels. However, one of their challenges is what I talked about, market concentration. They have not been able to make sure that the country is not, the markets are not as highly concentrated as they are right now. That is, as I mentioned earlier, when in 1994, only five companies owned the majority of the JSE. So now, the important thing is that you can't, if you want an economy to move forward, you have to make sure that there is freedom of entry. As I mentioned in that market structure of perfect competition, even though perfect competition cannot be achieved, but you want market entry. So I wouldn't say that the Competition Act and the Competition Commission doesn't have teeth. However, it's been evolving. From the 1950s, 1970s up till now, it has been, the competition policy has been evolving. Remember, in the beginning, there was the cartels. I mentioned earlier that over a period of 20 years, only 18 cases were heard and nothing serious happened to them. But now, post-1999, when the Competition Act came into effect, post that, there have been cartels, the Competition Commission has been able to prosecute cartels. They've done a lot of work. However, it's still important for this economy to make sure that the wealth is distributed to all. It is not highly concentrated in the hands of a few. And that is one of the reasons why this act had to be amended, because the Competition Commission wants more power that will enable them to deal with market concentration and abuse of market power. I mentioned earlier that there was an issue with Sasol of abuse of dominance. The case was overturned by the Competition Appeals Court. on technical grounds. So those are some of the issues that need to be threshed out. So the competition policy has been very effective. However, it has there's more that needs to be done still, especially in terms of those policies protecting small businesses and redistribution of wealth in the economy. I hope that answered your question in part.
Thanks, Nwabisa. You know, in the competition law, if we can just understand this keyword, cartel, corporate leniency, enforcement, fines, I think also penalties. Those are some of the issues that I think as Competition Commission is coming now, they're going to be dealing with. So it is important that we understand all this. What do we mean by penalties? What do we mean by corporate leniency? What do we mean by cartel? What is competition law all about? The reason why I asked Nwabisa to take us through this is because sometimes we take it for granted that we understand this thing. I mean, even normal, general lawyers, if they haven't studied business law, they might not even understand, have a clue on what competition law is all about. So it's a specialized field. So we must just accept that. And as members of parliament, having a responsibility to oversee the work of our competition authorities, it is important that we also have a clear understanding of this entity. Otherwise, we might want to hold accountable an entity that we do not even understand the work that they are doing. They've been coming in and out to brief us on various issues, but if we really do not have a grasp of what of the work that they are doing, we might not be able to do our work as expected by the legislature and our people out there. Remember, cartels are associations of suppliers or manufacturers which their aims or their purpose is just to maintain prices at a higher rate or level. And the main intention is to restrict competition. So really, if countries come here, their big firms come to South Africa, they don't just come to South Africa. This is a planned move. They plan which market can we take advantage of, for instance. And then they decide, okay, we're going to South Africa. It's not by chance. They come to South Africa because they saw a particular weakness, or they wanted to capitalize on some of the weaknesses that that market might be, or not necessarily on the weaknesses, but they might have wanted to capitalize on the opportunities that are in place that the local firms might not see. So that opportunity itself might end up being something else that the country did not desire. But if you don't have regulations, if you don't have rules in place that govern such activities, economic activities, then you won't be able to detect where there are anti-competitive behaviors. So it is important that we understand those things from a political point of view, so that as we look at the laws that are before us, we are able then to look at them with an eye that would, at the end of the day, protect those that are vulnerable. Because now we want to open up our economy for those who have not been participating. We can't do that if we still have few dominating the market. If we're suffering from that in South Africa, can you imagine other countries that are neighboring with us? Because if they are also weaker and we are not stronger, we won't be able, therefore, to assist where we are supposed to be assisting. We currently know that in most of those countries that we're sharing borders with, they do not have very strong economies. They rely more on South Africa. And if we don't have stronger entities that would help protect South Africa, we might end up also being affected by the fact that they also lack such. So it's important that we share at all times and also have an understanding of what we're dealing with. This is a big monster for us, but it's not something that we're not going to be dealing with. It's a challenge that we need to look at, because if we don't embrace this challenge, by embracing it means we must open up for education, to be educated, and also learn more about this particular monster called competition law. After learning everything about it, focus on it, on the solutions, the possible solutions, but then how to derive, how to come to those solutions is through what we get from the authorities themselves as the practitioners, because they implement the act. So the challenges that they tell us of, we need to turn those challenges into opportunities, because we then say, these are challenges that need resolutions. How do we resolve on those challenges? And therefore, if we have an answer, we'll then come up with the alternative to those challenges. So all what we need to do is to make sure that we read as much as we can, understand our markets, our economy first, and then before we can understand other economies and other markets. I don't know if Competition Commission is here. Can we check in the meantime, because I was told that the commissioner was only able to catch the morning flight, so he will be here after 10. I hope that he's here. I don't know if you want to have anything else to say before we break in preparation for the next presentation. Silent means we have understood, and we are geared for this normal stuff. And that is Liane?
No, Chair, I just wanted to say what you said, but additionally just to thank the researcher for doing a good job of researching the subject and giving us the basics about the whole question of competition law. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Ntate Kleane. In the absence of further comments or questions, Novisa, thank you so much, Sisi, for the work well done. I think we are more wiser now than we were when we came in here. Remember, there's still more work to be done. We're going to deal with this on a continuous basis until we have a clear grasp of the law. So that as we deal with amendments, we know exactly what we're dealing with. Thank you so much. May we take just a 5 minute break? Thank you.
Are you still in the first move? Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Thank you. That's before they hear it. You see, what could happen is that they say we have potential right early in April. So we just move and they're on and it continues. Maybe we can. But I'm surprised that the number of people are impacting the spirit. I can tell if this is something wrong with society.
They're not
taking
the
seat. No? A lot of people don't, but a lot of people do. I'm quite surprised. I don't think anybody really can be out on that. We always say that you can't predict, like the donation by the elderly farmers I heard about. That is the same thing, you know, a massive lot of water.
Yeah.
Let's take this opportunity to welcome the report to give us your contribution towards our own education in as far as competition law is concerned. We are aware that the department and yourselves are in the process of amending the existing act with its amendment, especially the recent amendments. We are aware of the challenges that you've been giving us. We have been waiting for this, for the amended act, amendment bill, and finally, it's quite clear that it's before the public now for public consultation. We are not yet there as this legislature. We just want to be sure of what we understand about the current act before we even venture into the amended act. So that by the time we're given that opportunity, we already know what we are faced with and where we'd want to head to. So the clarity is very, very important for us. So we have been enlightened on the origins of the competition law. So not only in South Africa, but elsewhere. And what were the intentions there then? Why the competition law is so important for every market. So I think we do understand, we have a basic understanding. We'll be happy if you make us more wiser in as far as that is concerned. So as the brief you got already, and as I briefed the minister, I guess he did so with you. He further forwarded that information to you. So the floor is yours, Mr. Bonagela. Just for your own information, we have a new member that you haven't met. I know you met all of us, but there's a new member from the EFF You know the previous member, Mr. Mbatha. We have now Ume Shonyana, Dogoza Shonyana, who's representing the EFF. I think you can see the member in red, yes. Otherwise, we're still intact, you know, as you know us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Chair, and it's good to be back here in a city that's less hot than is usual. I hope, Chair, that I have understood the brief, because I did this presentation very quickly yesterday. So what I have decided to do is to maybe keep the presentation itself fairly short, so that there could be a lot more interactions on those areas that members may feel like maybe we need to talk about more, or where there are more gaps. But also thank you for the opportunity to do this. I thought that, Chair, I'll start with just introduction on the competition authorities. As you know, that the Commission is one of the three bodies that are tasked with enforcing the Competition Act, and us being the base, really, which does the bulk of the work, in the sense that we do investigations and people complain to us. And then you have the Competition Tribunal as the first, as a court of first instance, and the Competition Appeal Court as the final court of appeal on competition matters. There needs to be a rider there that the Constitutional Court, of course, always has the final authority on all appeals. So theoretically, at least one can still appeal to the Constitutional Court, but those instances are very rare in practice. So the Competition Appeal Court pretty much becomes the final court of appeal. It's a court that is headed by Judge Dennis Davis. The Competition Tribunal, as you know, is headed by Mr. Manoyem, and I head the Competition Commission. One of the mandate is, as I have outlined in those lines, the areas, the big areas of operation for practical purposes, I've divided them into four. The first and probably most important is cartel enforcement. Is enforcement in general. And the idea of enforcement is a simple one, that there are certain things that are prohibited, that people are not allowed to do, and we simply investigate and prosecute people who have done those things. So we become like really traffic cops when it comes to that. You can only drive at this speed, and if you exceed that speed limit, you may be prosecuted. We then divide the type of things that are prohibited into roughly three. The first one is what we call cartels, or sometimes collusion. We've also been criticized that we should call this corruption. This is where people get together and fix prices instead of competing with one another, or allocate markets. Market allocation, we've seen many different forms of this. Sometimes it's just geographic allocation, that you'll sell products in Gauteng and I'll sell in the Western Cape. That's a classic one. But actually, there are more sophisticated ways these days of doing that. People sometimes have customers and they agree that you will not poach each other's customers. We sometimes see this with companies forming empowered entities. And they will say the empowered entity will do government work and the sort of non-empowered entity will do private sector work. That in itself is also a form of market allocation because those companies are agreeing not to compete. The other form we've seen we saw in the cement was where people agree on market shares that you will have 30% of the market and the other competitor will have 30% and the other one will have 40%. And we monitor each other to make sure that we stick to those market shares. And if we see a change in market shares, then we know that somebody is cheating. And then there could be a cartel meeting again to try and find out what went wrong. The area of cartels, we'll talk about some more because it's one that I think is most prominent in our enforcement work now. In a sense, it's also the easiest to detect because these are people who are supposed to be competing and instead they agree not to compete. So first you must establish that these are competitors or at least people who are in the same line of business. Again, this can be tricky because people can make themselves not to be in the same line of business. Let me make... We've had instances where people decide not to enter certain markets and it looks like it's their own decision, commercial decision. But when you interrogate, sometimes you find historic agreements. There's a case we're doing now on people deciding that they will only do bulk and the other one deciding that they will do small packs. And this looks like a normal commercial decision. But when we interrogate, we find that there's a long historic agreement that you will do bulk and supply the guys who require that, and I will do the small packs for consumers. So you find those forms of market allocation as well. But there are many species of it. The other species which we have covered, I think, in this committee before is what we call tender collusion or tender manipulation, where people are supposed to respond to a tender independent of each other, but instead they would collude and sometimes allocate the tender to one of their own. Often this is done by way of rotation. So if we know that there is a regular contract that gets issued, instead of competing for each tender that's issued, we just decide that we will rotate. And the way of achieving that, that is the simplest, is that all others will either submit bids that will not qualify or that will be overpriced, so that the person who is intended to win the tender would win it. It doesn't always go right. They sometimes mishandle it, and the person who was not supposed to be allocated gets allocated the tender, and that's often when they come to report to us that there was something wrong in the process. And when we investigate and get more details, we uncover the whole scheme of how they had intended to allocate the tender. This affects people big and small. We've had a lot of small contractors. Some people just family businesses, individuals, sometimes not even incorporated, supplying very simple things to the state. Stationery, transcription services, people who will even come to the meetings using public transport. to the most advanced, who are highly sophisticated, multi-billion rand tenders who would come to the meetings using private jets. So it's literally everybody who gets involved with this. So that's the area of cartel. The second area of enforcement for us is what we call abuse of dominance. And maybe I can draw the distinction between the two here. Dominance is when you have a single firm that's dominating the market. Note that when a firm is dominating the market, it can achieve the same outcome that a cartel can achieve on its own. So in other words, the cartel, they get together because for them to raise prices, they need to cooperate with one another. But a dominant firm doesn't need to cooperate with anybody. It can simply raise prices. So in a sense, what the cartel tries to do is to mimic a dominant firm. Because once they are together, then they become dominant. Then they can charge high prices. But with a dominant firm, there's no need to cooperate with others. If you have 80, 90% of the market and you decide to charge the price you want, consumers have no other option but to come to you. And this is why there was then created this species of prohibition called abuse of dominance. There could be many forms of abusing that dominance. They are listed in the Act under Section 8 and Section 9. And just briefly, the forms that are most prominent is Exclusionary Act. So in other words, you can be so dominant and you exclude others from participating in the market. Let's give an example of a case. It's not the best case because we lost it, but the case of South African breweries, where they decided that they were going to use certain distributors. And if you try and distribute beer and you are not within their distribution network, you are left, I think the market outside of SAB is probably 7% or less. So if you can't be within that distribution network, it means you are excluded from the market because SAB has become a market in itself. So another example, again using the SAB fact, and I emphasize again, this is not the case that we won, so this is not, I'm not condemning the company, I'm just using it as an illustration. If you wanted to enter the beer market in South Africa, you would need access to the distribution network. And again, if that distribution network is owned by SAB, no one else is allowed to use that distribution network. It means you must invest in the similar network to get your beer reaching the most remote village or township. Now, to duplicate that network may be near impossible. So those are the sort of exclusionary issues we have looked at. I think another classic case, old case in South Africa, is a case of a small producer of poles that was selling in the Western Cape to the vineyards its poles. But to treat these poles, you needed a chemical that was sold by Sasol. And Sasol would discriminate against a small buyer by charging them higher prices. But they would all have to sell these poles to the same customers, which is the vineyards of the Western Cape. And if you were too small and you were not getting those volume discounts, you simply couldn't sustain yourself in the market. So that category is called price discrimination. It's under Section 9. Another form I'll talk about is called the essential facility doctrine. This we find in mainly network industries. So So a lot of complaints, for example, you would get against, let's use a hypothetical example that you wanted to, actually a live example is in telecoms. If you wanted to use a network and only a dominant firm, and at the time you had Telkom that owned most of the network, I think about 10, 15 years ago, the local loop that gives you access to people's homes, because they had fixed lines that enabled them to reach every household in the country. If you needed to sell internet services to a house, you needed to piggyback on Telkom's network, and that's an essential facility without which you can't get into a market. So that could also be an exclusionary thing if you exclude people from it, you refuse people access to that network. The last one we've spoken about here as well is called excessive pricing. This is a fairly complex one where a dominant firm is not allowed to charge an excessive price. An excessive price is also defined in the statute. It's a very, very controversial definition that's debated by the courts and academics all the time. And an excessive price is defined as a price for a good or service which bears no reasonable relation to the economic value of that good or service. So as you would appreciate, that definition still doesn't bring you to an answer when you see a price, because you must still determine what is the economic value of this product, so that you can be able to say that the price is not related, has no relation to the economic value. Hugely complex cases. So what I call the other prohibited conduct, I'm just going to use an example, a quick example. These are usually relationships between suppliers and manufacturers. So these are suppliers are situations where somebody sits above. In other words, they are not competitors. These are supply relationships. If, for an example, you supply a product to somebody and you tell them how much they must resell that price. So there's something we call resale price maintenance. If I sell you goods and you are going to resell those goods, I'm not allowed to tell you by how much you must resell those goods. The old case on this was the motor vehicle manufacturers, the OEMs, which told dealers how much they needed to resell the cars for. And that case was successfully prosecuted, and most of the manufacturers were found to have fallen foul of this provision. Another typical situations are situations of franchises. A franchise is not supposed to tell a franchisee by how much they are supposed to resell their products. They can tell them that the cost of this product is this much because they are selling it. They'll say, I'm selling you this bottle for 5 rands. And given the cost of producing this and distributing it to you, we think if you sell it for less than 6 rands, you may make losses. But that decision should be left to the person who is reselling. Sometimes people may want to discount. So for example, these days, if you are going to buy a motor vehicle, you can negotiate with the dealer. A brand new car, you can negotiate, because the Mercedes-Benz can't force the dealer on how much that car should be resold for. So that's about it on enforcement. Let me now, so enforcement, as I have said, is really prohibitions where we wait for somebody to break the law, just like traffic cops do. We wait for somebody, we can't anticipate. In other words, we can't stop it before it happens. We wait for somebody to break the law, then we can prosecute the person for breaking the law and impose penalties. In other words, if the market is already concentrated, there's nothing that this mandate can help us with. If somebody is already dominant, there's nothing we can do. They can abuse that dominance, then we prosecute them. But we can't punish them for being dominant. So this is where the mergers and acquisitions mandate complements this enforcement mandate, because the mergers and acquisitions is different. It's proactive. It says that when people are going to merge, we must now assess whether that merger will create the dominance so that we can be able to prevent it. Merger applications that are before us can be approved if they pose no problem. And in fact, most measures in the economy pose no problem. They can also be approved with conditions, or they can be prohibited. We prohibit usually under rare circumstances where we can show that there would be anti-competitive effects, namely high prices. I think high prices is the simplest one. But we can also show that there would be lack of innovation and things like that. Here, also what's important are public interest issues that we are mandated to look at when we're looking at the effect of the merger. So the effect of the merger on employment, on an industrial sector or region, on SMMEs, and on PEE. We can look at the impact of the merger on those and balance it with the competition issues. There are again many famous cases we have discussed here on this area. In the main, measures that pose public interest issues are resolved by way of conditions to ameliorate those effects. So if, for example, there's going to be employment issues emanating from a merger, we would usually impose remedies such as a moratorium on retrenchment. We could also order creation of a fund to retrain workers if retrenchments are inevitable, to have a social plan where workers can be retrained so they can get employment elsewhere. In certain instances, we've also made workers to be suppliers to the company. Say you can retrench them, but you must give them contract so that they can continue supplying you with the service by themselves. I should also mention that this is a mandate that also involves government directly. So enforcement doesn't involve government directly. The minister cannot come and say, prosecute this one, don't prosecute that one. Take this case, don't take that case. But in mergers and acquisitions, the minister has a right to intervene to protect public interest. So you might have seen many instances where the Minister of Economic Development would have been involved in a merger transaction. The historic one, I think, was the Walmart case, where the minister, in fact, was not happy with the decision of the tribunal and went further to challenge it at the Competition Appeal Court. The other area which is new, introduced by a 2009 amendment, is an area of market inquiries. This area is where we are not enforcing, but we do a general probe on state of competition in a market without targeting a particular firm. So this is where we observe certain things that make us unhappy from a competition point of view. It could be high prices. It could be lack of innovation. It could be exclusion. So we are doing, for example, market inquiry into healthcare. That inquiry was triggered by high prices for private healthcare, above inflation prices. that prompted us to inquire. We're doing one on retail supermarkets. That one was prompted by exclusion. So if you go to shopping malls and you don't even have to be a competition expert, you will observe that you hardly ever find two retail supermarket groups that are competitors in one shopping mall. And I can tell you the only exception that they allowed is usually Woolworths. And that's because most of them don't regard Woolworths as a competitor. But in every shopping mall, you cannot find a Checkers and a Pick n Pay. And that's not by miracle, it's by design. You also cannot find an independent retailer. So you can just observe this, that you are not saying somebody has broken the law, but you're saying what causes this. You can then inquire, why are there no fresh produce suppliers in a shopping mall? Why are there no butcheries? Why are there no independents? Once you have then made a determination, you can then make recommendations on how to address that problem. So it's not prosecution driven, it's really inquisitorial. You're trying to find out what is the problem by observing the outcome. Often the outcomes are not contagious. So for example, if you talk to Pick n Pay or Checkers, they won't deny that they are not found in a single shopping mall. They won't deny that. Perhaps they will have other explanations why they are never together in a shopping mall. This is what we try to find out. Advocacy is really a subspecies of these other three. This is where we talk now to stakeholders. We talk to business to voluntarily comply. We talk to government to make sure that the laws, policies, and actions are consistent with competition principles. So for example, we could go talk to, the major thing we're doing now is in the wood value chain, we're talking to all the stakeholders, government, because government has got some forestry interests. And those interests are very important for downstream industries, people who manufacture furniture. So how do you make sure that the conduct of government as a shareholder is consistent with its own industrial policy, which aims to promote entry and growth of the furniture sector? So that's the work we do. So sometimes we also talk to the unions, we talk to consumers, and we talk to Parliament, I think, on various matters that come up from time to time that affect competition. We talk to other regulators. So that is our advocacy function. So I thought, Chair, I would start with that because I think that is the bulk and the core of what we do. Now, I have also included a slide there on the background to the Competition Act, and that's really for members' interest. We can discuss that. I don't want to take too much of your time. I think everybody is familiar with the history of South Africa, and that's what I've tried to capture in that slide. Happy to discuss if you would want us to. Also included in the slide, I didn't talk about this, not because it's unimportant, but I thought that it gets covered quite often, the purposes of the Act and the objectives that are listed in our legislation. As you can see, those objectives cover what we call efficiency issues. Efficiency issues are issues around development of the economy, prices, product choice, and so on. But they also cover what I call developmental issues. That is the impact of competition on equitable opportunity to participate in the economy, the welfare issues. These are things like jobs and so on, as well as the issue of greater ownership. in the economy. So our law, at least aspirationally in terms of these objectives, aims to balance these efficiency objectives with the distributive or equity objectives. I think what we have sought to do, and this is my last slide, Chair, what we have sought to do then as an agency in order to grapple with this mandate, because you get the law, but then there's an issue of how do you practicalize the law in terms of implementation. We then developed a vision that what we want to do as a competition authority is to regulate for a growing and inclusive economy. And the operative word there being growing, because that's where the efficiency of competition rules enable you, make the economy dynamic and growing, but also inclusive. So you don't want an economy that benefits a few. You want an economy that's going to absorb workers, an economy that's going to absorb the previously excluded groups. And in order to achieve this vision, we have identified three strategic goals. The one is a simple, effective competition enforcement and measure regulation. If we stick to that mandate, we think half of the job will be done. The second one is strategic collaboration and advocacy. This is where we also spend a bulk of our time and resources on establishing strategic relationships to advance competition policy. Let me just mention one major piece of work we are doing. I think I mentioned this in the committee. This is where we're trying to open up the auto sector. So we're doing this in collaboration with the DTI because they are the ones who are funding the auto sector through industrial policy incentives. But we're saying after these incentives, let's look at the value chain. Who supplies components to these cars? Who repairs them? Who services them? Those are questions, because those questions impact on competition. So if the DTI gives them incentives and then they have a motor plan that locks every buyer to them for 5 years, it means you, that value chain is closed. Nobody can service those cars. People who have fleets, like government, they cannot even establish their own workshops or outsource that work to groups that they may want to empower because they are all on motor plan. So those are the type of things. You open up markets like that, and I can talk about so many other markets. The same thing we're doing on school uniform. School uniform is not just about the cost to parents. Cost to parents is very, very important, but it's also about who supplies uniform, and is that market open for all those who could compete. The third area is internally focused. This is where we want, aspire to be a high-performing organization, and this we do by optimizing our systems, our human resource capital, resources, systems, and processes. So this we have tried to, this in a sense tried to practicalize the work that we do. So Chair, overall, that is the presentation on the competition authorities. There are issues that I have left out, issues such as the recent criminalization of cartels. Is a huge debate, and I have deliberately left it also because of time. There are issues such as how the mandate of market inquiries is supported, and how we see this going forward. That's also a very huge debate that is partly covered by the amendments that the minister, I think, has released for public consultation. So those things are stayed away from them, but some of them, I think, could be interesting.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Bonakele, as usual. Very brief and precise, but very in terms of the content, very pregnant. I think we really appreciate this briefing because it refreshes our minds, and this time with a particular focus. And I like the fact that as you presented, you also gave us reminded us about the cases that you briefed us on previously. And I hope starting now, beginning of the year, we do understand what the competition authorities are doing, the structure, how they are structured, who's doing what, and the main focus of this body. Is there anything we'd want to ask? Is there anything, anywhere we want to comment or just elaborate on? This is your time to do so. Is that it then?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, the usual, you know, very clear presentation. I want to focus on one aspect that you raised in the presentation. You indicated that if you lose a case at the level of the competition appeal court, it is rare that you go to the constitutional court. Now, there are some major cases that you have handled but had a lot of public interest in them. Can you explain to us the mechanism or criteria that you use in determining that you are not going to refer a case, for instance, to the Constitutional Court, even though you felt very strongly, you know, when you started that matter? If you could give us that explanation, because if it happens rarely and companies get an opportunity to appeal at the CAC, I think there is a conflict there, you know, for the general public. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Klen. Any other question? Dr. Kado, and then Mfundo.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks, Commissioner. I was just wanting to know how much input did the Commission itself have into the amendments that were gazetted in December, particularly around the new powers that are given to the Commission in terms of market inquiries?
If you're comfortable with that question, we'll continue with it. But if you feel no, you will await that time when you come before the committee, it's fine. Ma'am Fulo? I just need, my question is around when you say that if companies are merging, sometimes there's a social plan, and you also encourage to employees as suppliers that are going to be retrenched. Who is monitoring this? Because I've seen most of the time it becomes a talk shop. At the end of the day, the people who are retrenched are still losers. And then the other issue around the market inquiries, you make an example with the healthcare in the retail supermarket. Is it something that is, how far it is now, still under investigation, or what is happening there? Thanks, Ma'am Fuller. Any other question or comment? I just want to find out, again, you know, in terms of excessive prices, or pricing. I'm going to ask this question from just a layperson's point of not point of view, but rather ignorance. Dominance of foreign firms occupying South African market. Obviously, they depend, their growth depend on the currency where they're coming from, especially where they have dominant currency. Obviously, in importing goods, those goods would be valued according to the currency they were bought. And if they come to South Africa, the pricing thereof would be of that foreign currency equaled to the local currency, or made equivalent to the local currency. Same thing applies to the remittance sent off. That would also be expensive if their currency is valued higher than the local currency. How do you normally see that kind of a transaction? And meaning that, how would you classify that? Or you haven't looked into that, because my view, as I said, it's a layperson's, from the layperson's point, is that unless those goods or products were acquired with the value that could be afforded locally, the value of that good or goods or services would be made to be more expensive because, in terms of pricing, because of how they were acquired. Is that wrong, or where does that fall into? Because currently things are very expensive. I'll give you an example. Cars imported from elsewhere. Those vehicles, they come to South Africa. When you look at that, very expensive. Some are produced in South Africa, but parts are imported. And when you look at the value of euro, for instance, as a currency, the value of dollar, the pound, and then these are the major cars, I mean the top-notch cars that we import to South Africa, that gets imported to South Africa by particular firms. As they come to South Africa, they come with that kind of a, from that kind of a currency lower to the local currency. No, I'm using the wrong word. Converted to the local currency. How fair is that to the local market? Because currently also, the research has shown that South Africans, in terms of the experience CDI, consumers, that is the Consumer Defaulters Index, consumers in South Africa, the rate of defaulting is growing even higher. So my worry is it not one of the causal factors? Last year we heard that the cars sales have increased so much, and their contribution, car sale contribution into the economy, is actually boosting our economy. But we did not know that it's at the expense of the consumers. And then that consequence, you see it now with this particular report. So I'm worried about that, because this might be another area. But then before I come to that conclusion, although I have made it already, I would want you to really educate me. Maybe there's something I'm missing in terms of the pricing caused by the currency market, because that's another area.
Thank you, Chair, and I then would like to take, I'd like to take your offer not to respond to Dr. Cardo's question. On the appeals to the Constitutional Court, we obviously look at a variety of factors, one of which would be the reasoning of the Competition Appeal Court itself and the importance or novelty of the matter that they had to decide on. I think you've touched on something that is still somewhat unsettled in terms of what is the appetite of the Constitutional Court itself to decide on competition, which are essentially economic questions. Personally, and this is just my view, I think that in the past, the Constitutional Court has not shown much enthusiasm to hear these economic cases. And I can back that up with the cases that we have referred to the court, and the court has elected not to hear them. The trouble is that you can't really debate it when the Constitutional Court says they will not hear your case because you don't have good prospects of success, because they can just have that one line, and that would be the end of it. So we've sent a few cases there. This SAP case was one of them, on the distribution. We also sent excessive pricing cases. Actually, I was thinking that the Constitutional Court would be so enthusiastic to hear an excessive pricing case because it has never had one. So it was the only opportunity for it to give its views on the standard. But again, it declined to hear that case. I think we are pushing a lot of cases now. We have about two cases now, which we have referred to the court. There's one case where there has been a reduction of a fine. The Competition Appeal Court reduced the fine. We think that it shouldn't have interfered with the fine that was imposed by the tribunal. We sent it to the court to see what it says about that. There's one case where the party refused to notify a merger, which we were saying is a notifiable transaction. It's a very well-known company. We have also escalated that to the Constitutional Court. There is the famous SAPC multi-choice agreement, which is now before the Constitutional Court. So I'm saying that we started from a low base, but I think they are getting a number of cases. So it's going to be very interesting to watch what the court does with these cases. So in the past, I can say that they have not shown an appetite, but I think there are more interesting cases that are before them, and we will see if they take them up or not. And as I said, we can't criticize them because they don't give us reasons why they won't appear, they won't hear the cases. That's my only gripe with the Constitutional Court, is that, I mean, if it decides not to hear your case, it doesn't have to give reasons. It can give one line. Say, we won't hear it because you don't have good prospects of success. That's it. So, but I think let me stop there because I'm still going to litigate before that court. On the conditions on measures and social plans, the Competition Commission is the body that's tasked with monitoring compliance. If we have imposed conditions or the tribunal or courts have imposed conditions. So if there are people where the conditions, for example, have said there should be no retrenchment, if there are retrenchments, we are the ones to enforce those conditions. I would accept some criticism that this is not... I think we've done well, we created some capacity. There's a team now at the Commission that's dedicated to monitoring compliance with conditions, and we're really going for them. We get reports as the executive on all the conditions that have been imposed. But the trouble is when you're dealing with companies that are not willing, so this was imposed, they were not willing. It's not, I don't think we have very strong instruments. I'll give you an example. If the condition was saying you are going to close one factory, but you must take those workers from that factory and give them jobs in another factory. We've had those conditions where it becomes so difficult now because it's individual workers. They will say, well, they have refused. Sometimes they come and say they have refused. But when you talk to the workers, maybe the conditions were such that it was practically difficult moving people from one town to the other town. Do you provide for them for a period of time for relocation? The condition might not talk about those things. Sometimes you say you must re-employ people. We've had conditions like that, and the companies will say, we can't find them. We've done everything we could to find them. So it's not easy for us as well to have a machinery that can enforce strict compliance. It helps a lot when there are third parties, such as unions, who also could help with what's happening on the ground. And here is where I'm talking about instruments, Chair. If somebody doesn't comply with the condition of a merger, the only thing we can do right now is to undo the transaction. Just imagine now, if we were to say there was a non-compliance with one, let's say one person who was supposed to be re-employed by Walmart was not re-employed. The only condition we can impose is to undo that merger. So it's like you can't impose any other sentence. It's a death sentence. It's the only sentence you can. So we've raised this as well to say that maybe we've got to look at other mechanisms. Maybe you can find them. Maybe, you know, there could be some other things that you can do to force them to comply. Maybe, if you want, there could be a criminal offense for the executives who are meant to comply. But to now want to undo an international transaction is could be impossible. So there are those challenges with the law as it currently stands. But the mandate is ours, so I would accept any criticism. I would say that any criticism should be directed at us. Market inquiries, how far we are, just to say that we are doing an inquiry into healthcare. This inquiry should be finishing by August with everything going according to plan. We have an inquiry into the retail sector. We should be getting a provisional report on this inquiry before the end of the financial year, which would mean that it should be finalized also in the next, before the end of the next financial year. We have an inquiry into data services. This is the inquiry that government has called for and gave us a very strict deadline of 12 months to try and complete it. It's not going to be completed within that 12 months. It's going to take slightly longer than that, partly because there's resource requirements as well. And then the last inquiry we are doing is one on public transport. That's a hugely complex inquiry, and just to indicate how it, where it emanates from. So you have in public transport a lot of complaints that they have been coming for a while now by taxi operators alleging that they can't compete fairly with buses because buses are subsidized by the state. You also have now new issues with meter taxi people saying that Uber is being favored in terms of regulations. They don't have to comply with certain regulations, and that this distorts competition. So that's the second issue that's emerging. It has also emerged that the subsidies for public transport are also, there are some discrepancies. So if you look at rail, you compare it with buses, but also rail within itself. So if you compare the Gautrain, and if you compare the subsidy of the Gautrain to the subsidy of the rest that PRASA gets, there's also some discrepancies there. So it's quite a complex one, which we had set a period of 24 months to finish. I think it's going to be quite complex because we're now realizing that we were planning that we were going to do taxis. We're going to do each mode. We do taxis, we do buses, we do rail. But actually, if you look at what people are complaining about, it's actually the interface between the modes and the disparities on how these are funded. And obviously, you're going to need to take government on board as well, because they're the ones making policy on subsidies and things like that. So in a sense, you are encroaching also onto the sphere of the policymaker. So I think it's going to be quite a complex but also important inquiry. If I may then come to this issue of foreign firms' excessive pricing and the impact of currencies. Chair, I think there are many things that are involved in this question, and I'm not necessarily an expert in all of them. The one thing that South Africa at this stage doesn't regulate is, well, it doesn't regulate in terms of saying yes or no to foreign direct investments. So if there's a merger transaction that involves a foreign firm, there is no law you can invoke in South Africa that says you may not do this transaction, or you may not enter this market, you may not acquire here. Again, that's a decision by the policymaker, the decision that I do respect. But sometimes I find that expectations are that we would stop a merger. So when an Arab company was buying V&A Waterfront here, you had a huge problem with people coming saying, you know, why can't you block this? It's a strategic area, very important for the country. But actually, there's no law you can invoke to stop that. If the owner decides to sell to a foreign firm, we just look at competition issues and the specified public interest issues. This happens a lot. Chair, I'm glad you asked this question because I think you might also have to help us explain. This happens a lot when, like, a national champion is being acquired. So if you have a firm, I think SAP was one of those as well, where really an old South African company was being acquired by a foreign firm. And the expectations were that we could somehow block this. The reality is that you can't. There are many examples of countries that do regulate some of these. So if you go to the US, for example, it will there is a committee that looks at foreign direct investment from a national security point of view. And the government in the US retains the right to block those transactions. So there have been a couple of Chinese transactions that have been quite controversial in the US, where the US government has stopped the acquisition of US companies by these. I think Europe is looking at this law right now. Europe traditionally also has not had this type of law at a European level. They are now looking at this. And it's really a trade issue when I look at it in Europe, because they are complaining that they need to level the playing field with, again, largely large markets from the East and companies coming from the East investing in Europe. They feel that the level playing field is not level when their own companies go and invest there. So the state, the government in Europe now wants to have some power to say yes or no. So I'm saying that that's a political decision. It's not going to be done by agencies like ourselves. That's a political decision on whether you want foreign direct investment regulated more tightly or you want to keep it open. So the other issues that are quite important also, Chair, is there is an intersection of industrial policy on some of these, because some of the industrial policy incentives in fact support foreign firms. So let's use the auto sector. We know that South Africans are paying more for cars, because we have closed the market. So it's very difficult to import cars in South Africa. And the cars that are produced locally are very expensive. That's deliberate. We've protected our market in order to keep the jobs of the auto sector. Right? That's, again, a big political question. I mean, I think last year we paid about $8 billion into the auto sector as subsidies. So those jobs, we are the ones who create them, because that's a direct subsidy coming from taxpayers. The other one, which is not quantified, is the price at which the South African public buys cars. That's also a huge subsidy. So again, I think that's a policy, that's a big policy question. And I would admit that it's complex. I mean, Australia has now decided to remove subsidies for the auto sector, because they think that they benefit the OEMs and their home countries more than they benefit Australia. But that's a cost-benefit analysis that they have made. that we will rather take the money and retrain our workers, and they can be absorbed by Australian-owned sectors rather than giving money to foreign firms in order to employ Australians. But fortunately, that's not for me to decide that. And related to that would be trade policies, because there has been a big issue, for example, around this issue of chicken, on whether you protect the local market by raising tariffs and therefore getting people to pay a little more for chicken, or you open it up and then you have a flood of American and Brazilian chicken. It's a huge trade-off. Our submission on this area has always been that we are taking short-term decisions, because the issue is about competitiveness. It's whether our guys can compete. Remove all the subsidies and see whether they, because you can protect them only for a certain period of time before the U.S. forces you to open up, because actually this is what has happened now. So if you continue, you want to benefit in AGOA selling your C-class into the U.S. market, then you've got to open up your poultry sector. That trade-off is very, very difficult to manage if your poultry sector is not competitive. And competitiveness of the poultry sector depends on other policies, like other countries decide to subsidize animal feed. There's nothing stopping you if you can produce maize, if you produce grain in large quantities, you have surpluses. Other countries decide that grain could be used to support competitiveness of other sectors that employ people, your poultry, your production of beef, and things like that need animal feed. Some of these submissions we have made to the relevant government departments on trade-offs, because there's no policy that has no negative consequences. But you always have to weigh what is in the long-term best interest of the country, and we're not always together on that.
Thank you. I deliberately asked that question. I had a follow-up actual question to that on collaboration. I think we did ask this question before, whether you do collaborate with other entities, economic regulatory bodies, for such purposes. Because I believe if we open up for that, then it's going to be easier, because you'll know what the left hand is doing, the right hand will know what the left hand is doing, and so forth. So in that way, you will be protecting the interest of South Africans, because, you know, the way we're doing things is like, yes, we're doing, but we don't have, you know, the same objective, all of us. Some people, they are guarding silo-wise, their mandate in a silo way, and it becomes very difficult, therefore, to get a common understanding from all sectors. That's where my worry is, because if economic regulatory bodies would sit down and say, okay, from my point of view, this is what is happening, and therefore, I'm prepared to do 1, 2, 3. And from your side, this is what you're doing, and you're prepared to do 1, 2, 3. In that way, I think we can, you know, in a uniform manner, be able to deal with some of these challenges. Yes, there are challenges of the developing economies, but at the end of the day, if developing economies don't protect themselves, I don't think there's anybody else is going to do so. We're going to be continuously dominated by the developed economies, and I'm not sure for how long have we. I'm worried because they are playing us. Right now ahead, Britain has now elevated Naira, accepted Naira, as one of the currencies that can be used. I mean, that's playing Africa against Africa. To me, it's a battle of currencies now. And how are we going to survive if we don't look at currencies as also another area that we need to be looking at in terms of competition? I'm not sure. I was asking that deliberately because I was trying to ignite something that I know you would have responded the way you responded. It's fine. I'm satisfied with that. If you throw it back to us, it's fine. It's a challenge I'm accepting. But it's a discussion that we must, as South Africans, continue, you know, talking about. You wanted to come in again?
Yes, thanks, Chair. I think that there are pointed questions I do want to leave related to this. I think it's good that we have in a sort of a less formal accounting way, because there is sometimes a sense that when it comes to measures that questions about whether the executive is interfering or not. And I think these questions are very important in clarifying the law, because one doesn't want to depend on who is a minister at that particular point in time. One wants to rely on the law. Right? So I think we have to evaluate the efficacy of our laws. Right now, it is a choice that we have made, choice this parliament has made, on regulating foreign direct investments, that it will be through public interest interventions by the executive. That's the choice that's been made. You don't have an economy-wide law that says a committee would look at whether the investments are good for the country or not. You don't have that. And so it is going to be done transaction by transaction. That's the nature of the law we have. The second thing that I think is quite pointed is the role that competition authorities in relation to other regulators and policymakers is only advisor. I'll give you an example. If we talk to government departments all the time, so if we have a plan to say, let's open up the school uniform, I think is the easiest one. If the Minister of Basic Education decides that I actually don't want to regulate this sector, it's not an issue, this issue of uniforms. You can only try and persuade. There's no, that recommendation has no binding effect or even a special status. It's got persuasive value. So we persuade people. Some people respond well, some don't. Their directors general have taken a year to get them to even meet. There are others, they would get a letter, they would respond immediately, and they will work with you in trying to resolve the matter.
If I hear you well, you're advocating for a particular body that would look, you know, have a global look at this issue that are affecting all the sectors, so that it's not about a particular individual, it's about the interest of the country, is that what you're saying? Okay, I think we note that, and going forward, we'll have to look at some of those issues. Competition issues, quite interesting, as always. and intriguing as always. So can we agree that as of today, although we have the whole day, this is a committee week, we have the whole day until Friday afternoon to do the committee work. But today we'll leave it here, and tomorrow I will hand over. Just give me 2 seconds. Babu Bonakele, thank you so much for really always availing yourself for as long as you're available in the country. Upon getting a request from us, we really value this relationship with yourself. We know that we must always hold you accountable, but there are some people who do not believe in that. But you've always been there for us. And our relationship means so much to us, because the more cordial our relationship is, the more you make it easier for us to represent our people. Thank you so much for this. This is just the beginning of our interaction, especially on the continuous education and empowerment of members. We just don't want you to come here only when we seek, you know, accountability or want accountability, but it's also part of education. We feel that we must also utilize you as a resource so that you are able to educate us even further. Thank you so much for availing yourself. Members, as it looks like today, because we had requested to go and on oversight locally, in the Western Cape, our application is still before the House Chair. We were hoping that at least today we would get a response. It's just unfortunate that up to now we haven't received any response. But should we get any response, we had hoped that at least tomorrow we'll be leaving and then come back on Thursday. I will therefore request members to be on alert. Tomorrow we are given just the afternoon, because the morning part is taken by something else. From the afternoon and Thursday, if tomorrow we are not getting anything up to the end of today, if we don't communicate otherwise, know that there's nothing. But should we communicate, we request that you avail yourself. We wanted to go and view or oversee the, our focus now is on tourism sector. We want to look at, follow up on the NGP targets. How can we assist also in ensuring that the targets as put by the sector in 2010 are adhered to, and or otherwise look at the hindrances thereof. So this is what we wanted to look at in the Western Cape. Otherwise, let me also thank you for availing yourselves for this particular workshop. We can only become wiser if we continuously educate ourselves. Thank you so much for your attendance, and the meeting stands adjourned.